Branford Marsalis has been associated with jazz since he started blowing horn for Art Blakey at the age of 19. Stints with Clark Terry, Herbie Hancock, and Miles Davis enthroned him in the upper echelon of jazz saxophonists. But in 1986, Marsalis decided to branch out. He recorded an album of classical compositions. Romances for Saxophone featured a surprisingly timid Marsalis, applying broad strokes to such works as Eric Satie's Gymnopédie No. 3. Last year, Marsalis recruited the producer of that album, Tom Mowry, to work on a new classical recording, this time with the acclaimed Orpheus Chamber Orchestra. The resulting CD, Creation, combs through the catalogs of a number of French composers, among them Claude Debussy, Jacques Ibert, and Darius Milhaud. The CD also features a new version of the Satie piece Marsalis recorded 15 years ago. He says the decision to record the same work twice wasn't an artistic one.
It was a mistake.
What do you mean it was a mistake?
It was a legitimate mistake. It was the first one, I think, was the original Satie orchestration. The second version was based on a Debussy orchestration. But what Debussy did was change the numbers. And Gymnopédie No. 1 by Satie is No. 3 when Debussy orchestrated it. And 3 is 1. So this time we were doing No. 1 thinking it was No. 1 when it was actually No. 3, which was the same thing that I had done the first time. So even though I had the same producer from 15 years ago, 15 years is a long time. We had no idea until we'd already recorded it that it was the same piece. So Tom calls me and says, I have some very interesting news for you. It seems we've recorded the same piece over again twice. I say, well, which one do you like better? He says, oh, the new one. I said, then it was worth it. Let's move on. At least we get to show that there's some progress going on, you know?
Oh, there's progress going on. That's what makes it so interesting, is to listen to both versions of it. I mean, you know, who is the Branford Marsalis who was recording? Were you even playing the same instrument?
Oh, it was the same instrument.
Yeah?
I was less mature.
Yeah.
Like a real young wine, you know? I was playing it like a, you know, like a 2000 Blush Chablis by Ernest and Giulio Gallo back in 85.
And
not that Chablis ever get any better, but the point is it was really cheap. They don't get much better. But, yeah, 15, the 15 years has helped. I've become a better musician, thank God, in the last 15 years. And there's empirical evidence of that by listening to those two, A being those two performances.
Few in the music community would deny that Branford Marsalis has the chops, but some have questioned his focus. He stunned fans of his jazz work when he played pop music with Sting, delved into hip-hop with his Buckshot LaFunk project, and explored classical performance. Branford Marsalis still treasures his accomplishments in jazz, but he remains unrepentant.
Once people give you a label, there's a certain expectation that you are going to behave in a certain way. I've never really declared that once, like if somebody affiliates me with Sting or affiliates me with the Grateful Dead or affiliates me with Miles Davis or Dizzy Gillespie or Art Blakey, I mean, it doesn't mean that I'm just that one thing.
Listening to you talk about the number of people that you've played with, I mean, it's impossible to peg you.
They keep trying, though.
Sure. Well, isn't that the music business? Don't you think
that... Well, that's the human business.
Hmm.
That's the human business. We all want to be part of some group somewhere, whether it's the yuppies or Generation X or baby boomers. Everybody wants to, or the hip-hop generation. Everybody wants to take some word and say, this is all the things that I am. And I don't know, it's just never worked for me.
Hmm.
You know, it probably helped that I was a black kid growing up in Louisiana in the 60s who went to predominantly white Catholic schools. How's that for confusion? You know, I mean, you grew up in a neighborhood where everybody's listening to James Brown and Aretha Franklin and Earth, Wind & Fire. And then you go to a school where everybody's listening to Procol Harum and, you know, Yes and Led Zeppelin. And I had the best of both worlds because I got to be exposed to ultra-hip music on both sides. Whereas the Catholic kids were like, you know, don't bring that ghetto stuff over here. And then all my friends at home was like, man, don't bring that white boy stuff over here. So, I mean, I looked up and realized that I didn't really belong to either group.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to start this new hybrid group of, like, you know, space travelers or something. And we, you know, just there were about six of us in New Orleans that I knew where we just liked music. And we weren't willing to allow our other people's social expectations of us to limit our appreciation of different types of music.
The Marsalis household was also a hotbed of musical inspiration. Branford credits his father, Ellis, for his love of jazz, and his younger brother, Winton, for the introduction to classical music. But where Winton jumped into that genre with both feet, Branford approached it a little more gingerly. That doesn't mean he shies away from a challenge. On Creation, Branford Marsalis deliberately chooses complex pieces and executes them with confidence. Let's talk a little bit about the Ibert concertino, because this is when you actually are playing in concert now, when you're appearing with the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra. Tell us, first of all, about the composer and what it was he was writing here.
There were these group of composers in France called the Six, and he was one of the Six, and one of the few that actually decided to write something for saxophone, which was treated as one of the crudest, most horrific instruments ever invented by most people in symphonic music. He wrote a piece in tribute to Sigurd Rascher, and it's a piece that is part of the standard saxophone repertoire. Anytime somebody does a symphonic saxophone record, they always play the Ibert. When played right, it's a very wonderfully written piece of music. Unlike some pieces where the saxophone melody seems to be sitting on top of the orchestration, it is actually right in the middle of the orchestration. And it's not always the lead. It's, you know, when sometimes you're playing, you have to play behind the orchestra. Sometimes the counter lines and counter melodies that other members of the orchestra are playing that are just as important and sometimes more important than your lines and what you're playing. So you have to really learn the score well enough to understand when you're supposed to be heard and when you're supposed to shut up.
This is really an exercise in using that instrument that you have and not only communicating what the composer is doing, but what the entire ensemble is doing and then what you're supposed to do.
Yeah, and you still have to play it beautifully. That's the challenge. It's one thing to play slow pieces beautifully, because most of the times with slow pieces, that's what you're supposed to do. Huh. You don't really have any other requirement other than beautiful playing. But it's hard to play pieces that are fast and play them with a certain kind of joy or beauty or wonder without getting so caught up in the technical aspects that it becomes a technical marvel. The Scaramouche is pretty cool, you know, because it's a lot of notes and all that stuff, but it has the proper amount of joy. It sounds happy, and it's supposed to sound happy when you play it. Sometimes it's easy to get so wrapped up in the notes that you lose sight of what the purpose of the music is. And I found a way to dwell on the notes, but not so much that I lost the joy of the piece. And I really was happy about that.
There's a lot that's being said on this recording that is about the history of music, I think. I mean, you are doing the work of French classical composers who had a tremendous influence on American jazz. Maurice Ravel, for example, he seems to be a key to what you're doing here. I read a review of a concert that you had given, and the writer said, quoted Ravel as saying, Americans take jazz too lightly. And the French classical composers took jazz very seriously. Are you, on this recording, I think, trying to get us to begin to listen perhaps a bit more carefully?
Me? No. It sounds great, though. You set that up great.
Oh, thanks.
I wish I could say, yes, absolutely.
But it's a mistake,
right? You were reading my mind. I'm glad I thought of that. But, the recording process, the musical process, for me is very strange because it's incredibly selfish. When I'm thinking about the music, I'm thinking about me and what I want to convey. But at the same time, there's this relationship with the listener that you have to have. But I think that one of the things that separates any artistic statement from an entertainment statement is that the entertainer has to be completely on point with what it is that the audience wants or he's done for. So it wasn't like I was really intending to get people to listen to jazz more carefully or understand the relationship between jazz and symphonic music. I think that those that would gather that from listening to it probably already know that. And there's some people who just never like jazz and will appreciate this music, and that's good enough for me.
Were you nervous mm-hmm. when you went into some of these recording sessions? And, I mean, here you are with the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra. This is an orchestra that works without a conductor, which is pretty amazing. I mean, were you a little frightened?
Well, that's what we do. That's what jazz groups do. We don't have a conductor. Recordings are fine because you screw up, you can stop. Concerts. Now, there is terror. The Orpheus guys emailed me. Ronnie Bouch, who's the artistic coordinator, emailed me and said, due to chamber orchestra limitations on tour, a lot of the pieces on the record we can't perform in concert. How would you like to play the Max Dubois concerto? It's another saxophone concerto. And I said, yeah, well, I remember dealing and dallying with it in college, which was 20 years ago, so why not? So then I pull out the music and realized it was just a huge mistake to say yes to that, because there's so many notes. I mean, I can't tell you how many notes that thing has. It's just got notes everywhere. The page is black with notes. And I looked at it and said, this was a severe miscalculation on my part. So I started practicing this piece feverishly and actually pulled it off to an appreciable degree, but standing on stage in complete dread every time. There's one concert in San Francisco when I practiced the piece so much in such a short period of time that in some point of the concert, I turned a page and the music fell to the floor. Boy, you're in trouble then. And I didn't know what to do, but I somehow memorized the first movement. So I just kept playing it and, like, trying to figure out how I'm going to get it off the floor. One of the violin players, his name's Guillermo, And Guillermo gets up and puts the music back on the stage for me. And I say, great. And I look at it, and it's upside down. So I'm like, well, great. That's great. It's upside down. I got through the first movement fine. And, you know, people were laughing, and it was fine. Because I kept reaching for the page during the little pauses. But there were only two beats of pauses in 2/4 time. So you only had four beats to grab it, and it was never enough time. I got through the first movement. I don't know how. I memorized it. Fixed the music, or so I thought. Played the second movement without incident. Got to the third movement. And the last page was the second page of the piece. It was completely the wrong page. So I'm like, oh, my God. And then for whatever reason, I memorized most of the third movement right to a spot when there's a two-beat pause, and then the orchestra starts again. And when it got to the two-beat pause, I just said, I'm sorry, to the orchestra. I can't remember the rest of it, so just give me a second and let me get these pages straight. And the audience cracks up. You know, it was one of those hysterical kind of things. I said, I'm really sorry. I don't even know how I memorized this much of it, but I got to get this straight, you know. And everybody kind of stopped, and I have 2/16th notes, which leads us back in, so I got the pages right. There's only, you know, a third of a page left, but it was a crucial third of the page. I said, you ready? Diddle it, and we go, and we finish the piece. And the people, of course, they love that kind of calamity, you know. It puts, like, a certain kind of humanity to it. But we've since retired that piece, I'm happy to say. So I don't really have heart palpitations when I play anymore, but I'm working on that piece because I'd like to play it again and not sweat so much when I play it.
Oh. Branford Marsalis, his new recording. I don't know. How can I top this? I can't. I just have to say goodbye to you. And what a great story. Branford Marsalis, his new recording on Sony Classical is called Creation. And he joined us from the New York Bureau. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.